from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Novelist Daniel Mason's new book, A Winter Soldier, follows Lucius, a 22-year-old medical student who finds himself performing emergency surgeries in a field hospital during World War I. When he gets a patient who is so shell-shocked he can only communicate by drawing pictures, Lucius struggles to find a cure. I'll talk to Mason about his third novel and balancing writing with practicing psychiatry, his other career, and about the history and treatment of PTSD. And that's next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Daniel Mason's acclaimed third novel, A Winter Soldier, is set during World War I and follows a 22-year-old medical student working in a remote field hospital. The novel grapples with themes of war and love, and also with the effects of war on soldiers and how PTSD would have been seen 100 years ago. The effect of trauma on the brain is something Mason knows a lot about. He's a practicing psychiatrist and an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Stanford. And welcome back to Forum, Daniel Mason.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you. And World War I is very much in the news with the president worried about rain on his head, the Armistice Day ceremonies, and Adam Hochschild with a new book out about World War I. And, it's important in people's minds to go back to this history, which you do so well in your new novel. One of the things I wanted to start talking with you about, though, is I'm reading the novel and I'm thinking, where does someone like Daniel Mason come up with a character who is part of a well-to-do family, a Polish family, living in Austria, a medical student, 22 years old, in, around 1914. I mean, not out of whole cloth, obviously. So talk about the genesis of this character who we stay with throughout the whole novel.
Sure. So Lucius Kieślewski, he's 22 years old when the novel begins. And originally, the book was going to be about something very different. So actually began this probably about 14 years ago, working on a novel which was going to be about a period in the 1920s when psychiatrists had become very interested in the art produced by patients in asylums. It was one of the first real concerted efforts to understand patient experience from the patient side. And I was really drawn into that, and I wanted then to have a backstory for this doctor. A backstory for a doctor in the 1920s meant some kind of war service. And this was a time when I began to write, this was a time when I had recently graduated from medical school. And as I was reading about the histories of medical service in the war, I came across this anecdote about how medical students with really no clinical experience at all were volunteered or drafted into the conflict to serve in roles that they had no preparation for. This idea really resonated with me because I think I was intimidated by the responsibilities of what I was facing as well. And so this character then grew out of that. What put him in that social position, I guess, was I think in some ways I had just finished a novel, Far Country, which is about a girl growing up in a very impoverished area, very rural setting, and I felt the restrictions that her poverty placed on her and also for my potential in writing the book. And I think in this book I set out saying I want someone who can do what he wants to do, and that potential actually might be a problem for him. So a bit of a reaction in some ways, perhaps, against my prior book.
Well, he comes to a makeshift hospital, a field hospital, asking for the supervisor, and it turns out that the supervisor of sorts, ex officio supervisor, is a nun who carries a rifle around to shoot rats. I mean, the story gets us into a whole world, really, that you've invented here that is really quite rich imaginatively, and that takes us into a medical education, really, because he comes out, like many of these Dragoon soldiers who are not soldiers, who are medical medicos, comes out with partial training, as you just suggested, and then has to go into these amputations and surgeries. And he learns from the nun because she's been doing it.
Right. So he's a very good student at that point. He's learned very good book medicine, and he knows his textbooks quite well. And when he arrives at the front, he realizes, and I think he would have realized anyway, that the medicine that's practiced on the front is very different from the medicine that you learn from textbooks. This is true now. I think that his example is probably a bit more dramatic than what I experienced, but it is true to some degree now. And so he arrives there. The hospital has essentially been abandoned. The last doctor seems to have gone mad in some way and has fled, and then the rest of the nurses have died from a typhus outbreak. And this one nurse, Margareta, has remained. She has a couple orderlies to help her out, but really she's the main one who's taking care of the soldiers, which is one of the many early shocks for Lucius, who has grown up with the idea that the doctors, especially the very serious professors that he's watched back at the University of Vienna, are the ones who take care of patients. And so the idea that a nurse is the one who's running this hospital is at first a shock to him, but as time goes on, he realizes that he's going to learn all of his medicine from her.
You also get into really his head and how much he's drawn to medicine, how much he really is passionate about it and wants to be. The irony is, this would not be in a Jewish family. I mean, his parents don't want him to be a doctor. In fact, quite the contrary, like so many nationalists and strong believers in the nation and heroism and all that, that sent so many young men to war to die, especially in World War I. I'm thinking about all that great British war poetry of Wilfred Owen and Robert Graves and Siegfried Sassoon and so forth, going in as idealists. They wanted him to be a soldier, or they wanted him certainly not to be a doctor.
Right, right. So his father is a real traditional Polish cavalry officer who spends all of his time. He was actually injured in a previous conflict and has spent the rest of his life hanging around his garrison and singing cavalry songs and researching the history of his regiment. And so the idea that his son could follow in his footsteps is really his dream. That's the first moment that they connect over something. And his mother, who's very different, but is...
she's what we call a piece of work.
She's a piece of work, I think, is a good way of describing her. She's quite ambitious. She's quite aggressive. She's, in some ways, the difference between the father and the mother is a difference between traditional life and more aggressive capitalist nationalist sentiments. His mother's a true capitalist. She feels loyal to the Austrian crown when it serves her purposes, but very much wants an independent Poland, and is a shrewd businesswoman and recognizes that the family has made its money off of mining and they're about to make a lot of money during the war. And there's a chance that they're going to be accused of being war profiteers. And so what better way to avoid this accusation than have a sacrifice of your youngest son?
Well, you really got into the geopolitics even of Eastern Europe and what was going on in the war fronts, particularly on the Eastern frontier. I mean, the research is prodigious and it's woven in here. And if somebody were reviewing this book, they'd have to take into account that you have this freezing cold and you have all these diseases and amputations and some of them pretty well detailed. You're like your colleague Abraham Verghese. You get into some of the real medical detail here as a novelist and as a physician. But you've also got a love story going.
So the novel's set during a very dark period. And again, like I mentioned earlier, I didn't initially set out to write a story set in World War I. I wanted to write a medical story, and then eventually it became a medical coming-of-age story, and World War I seemed to be a great place to set it. It brought forth a lot of the questions that I was thinking about generally. But I, in facing the material, was, I think, myself a bit overwhelmed by the darkness of the experience. And so when a love story emerged, I hadn't really planned this, but when a love story emerged, I very much welcomed it as a place to take shelter in, which I think my character does as well, take shelter in this woman that he meets and the love between them that develops. It also began to occur to me as I was writing this that just because one's at war, just because one's serving as a doctor in war, doesn't mean that the normal concerns of everyday life for a 22-year-old suddenly go away. And so he's somebody who's at an age where one falls in love very hard. And so what's it like to be that person, but at the same time be in a hospital and have the responsibility for taking care of all these other sick men?
We're talking to Daniel Mason, novelist, author, psychiatrist. His new book is called The Winter Soldier, and he is a Stanford psychiatrist and writes about what now is known as PTSD. It used to be known as shell-shocked. Nerve damage, I suppose, is one way of seeing it at the time, contemporary time that he's writing about. And this is something that really gives the book its title. The Winter Soldier is not Lucius. The Winter Soldier is somebody who comes in a wheelbarrow in a semi-fetal position who has endured PTSD. He's fascinated with it. I mean, again, trying to find out where, even early on in the book, let me ask you to read something in the book early on, because it tells us about his fascination with this, just on page 15 early on, that paragraph about all the cases he studied. Could you read that for us?
Sure. But of all the cases he studied, it was the neurological ones that fascinated him the most. How extraordinary was the mind to sense a limb years after amputation, to see ghosts at one's bedside, to create all the symptoms of pregnancy, a swollen abdomen, amenorrhea, by wish alone. The thrill he felt when he solved the most difficult cases was almost sexual. There was a beautiful clarity in the patterns, the possibility of locating a tumor simply by whether it destroyed language or vision, the opportunity to reduce the complexity of other people to the architecture of their cells.
That's a paragraph that is lovely, but it also really gets us into his head and what motivates him and what his passion. But we're talking about a century ago. So little was known. I mean, still dark territory, a lot of it. But
right,
so, yeah.
Right. And there's a line in the book. One of his predecessors calls the mind the dark continent. And I think he's drawn to it for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, he's someone who is drawn to the science and it's fascinating, and who wouldn't be fascinated by neurology, but also he's somebody who's found other people a bit difficult to understand. And the normal social ways of understanding other people not as available to him as perhaps others. And so he actually goes about, realizes that this science, perhaps he dreams that this science is a way for him to make the basic human connections that everyone seeks.
Well, you know, Freud comes to mind here because he worked with a lot of mentally damaged and physically damaged soldiers, and he tried to figure out why they were he believed that, as I'm sure you know, the dreams were disguised wishes of the unconscious. And so how did it make sense that they were having these terrible nightmares? It was a kind of wish to move through the trauma.
Right. Freud's approach to shell shock and understanding of shell shock is complicated because on one hand, when the war broke out and all of these soldiers began to suffer what soon becomes apparent as a kind of psychological trauma. Prior to this, there was this sense that many of the symptoms that the men were experiencing, and so as an example, what really struck doctors in the early parts of the war was that men were experiencing, men on the front were coming down with physical symptoms for which they could find no clear explanation. And so the earliest cases that were described were people who, for instance, lost their vision, had changes to taste, couldn't walk. And at first there was this thought that perhaps this was due to a bomb going off and maybe microscopic particles going through their skull and affecting them somehow. But then slowly it began to be understood that perhaps these symptoms were psychologically caused. There was a model for this prior to this, and that was this model of hysteria, which is a kind of catch-all phrase that had been used in many different complicated ways,
particularly for women.
and there was this idea that a condition in which you can't, with physical symptoms that can't be explained, was thought to be quote unquote a disease of women. There are debates even that is it possible that men could be hysterics. And so there's this debate which is going on, and then all of a sudden the war occurs, and another psychiatrist at the time said that the war offered in ways, and I believe the term he used was a laboratory, all of a sudden to explore these ideas about how perhaps psychological trauma could produce physical symptoms.
But as you point out, the idea of somebody like Lucius is to get these soldiers back in battle, and the idea that somehow something organic is not the root of whatever their problems are, and there's very serious problems through trauma, should not necessarily entitle them not to go back to the service.
Right. So one of the complexities I think that a doctor at that time faced, and I think a doctor in any time, any wartime, is that they're torn between their loyalties. And actually Freud, since you mentioned him, put this very eloquently after the war when there was a trial of doctors for the abuse of soldiers during the war, and Freud was actually called to testify. And one thing that Freud pointed out was that the doctor in wartime was asked to serve a role which he compared to a machine gunner behind the lines, essentially a man sitting in a machine gun nest threatening to shoot any soldier who's trying to flee the front, to drive them back towards the war. And he said that it was against doctor's nature to serve like this. A doctor's nature is to cure the patient. It's not to make them well enough so then they can go off to fight again. And so doctors themselves were stuck in this conflict. What do you do if curing someone means sending them back into a conflict, which means they might get killed?
Again, our guest is Daniel Mason. His novel is The Winter Soldier, and there's a passage in the novel where Lucius does become pretty grim what he experiences, and he begins to identify very strongly with these soldiers, particularly the one who gives the novel its title. Becomes an eternal winter, or the feeling of an eternal winter descending upon him.
Right, right. So, and in some ways, this is the Winter Soldier, the title does refer to that character who arrives in the wheelbarrow.
Horvath.
And so this character in the beginning is not speaking, not communicating at all. But I think that Lucius, after taking care of him, after his experience, finds himself not as seriously afflicted as Horvath is afflicted, not as seriously afflicted as some of his soldiers are, but in many ways suffering a similar kind of post-traumatic, listlessness, loss, mourning, a kind of despair. He's experienced something which very few people in his world have experienced. And so when he goes back home, there's really very few people who he can connect with and talk about what it was like to serve as a doctor taking care of these patients. So in many ways, caring for themselves, caring for the patients is itself a traumatizing, overwhelming experience that he then has to find a way to overcome and find some kind of human connection around.
This was the war to end all wars, remember? That was at least the anthem that we heard during those years. Could you talk a bit with us about just, well, the moving from practicing medicine, psychiatry, and so forth, to the world of a novelist? I mean, in some ways, they're conjoined, certainly, in your work, and at the same time, very different resources called upon.
Right. So, I've been working on this book for such a long period of time that it's
14 years.
14 years. It's really crossed a number of stages of my training. So I can't say I have a regular pattern or thinking about how to merge the two worlds. Except that I think as time goes on, a concern that I initially had, which is that they would somehow conflict with each other, that concern has lessened a bit. And I've found that there is certain kinds of overlap.
There was an article in The New Yorker where you talked about having a wedding ring, and a wedding ring might make a patient assume something that you wouldn't necessarily want the patient to assume because you're this object of which you can transfer feelings onto and so forth, and or she. And that seemed to be a collision, you know. I mean, you know, you're a public figure, you're a novelist, and you get a lot of attention. People want to know about your life because they read your novel, and that's a natural kind of almost Pavlovian response. And yet at the same time, you have to keep that psychiatric distance.
Right. I think what the journalist was really touching on in that article is that I think the basic instinct that we have in psychiatry is towards discretion, towards quiet listening, towards saying really as little about oneself as necessary so that a patient's experience can come out. I'm not a firm believer in the complete blank slate. I wear a ring. In the article actually gets quite a bit into my...
Haven't we left a lot of that behind? Charles Brenner, right? You know, he said, come into a psychiatrist's office and you're wearing... you've got crutches, or, you know, you've got your arm in a sling or something like that. You have to wait to you bring it up rather than the psychiatrist bringing it up. I mean, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Right, right. And I don't know. I think that there's some people who still feel very strongly about a blank slate. I work in an inpatient hospital setting. I think in that setting in particular, people don't feel as strongly about it. But I think that there's a lot of wisdom to the general idea that what goes on between during the encounter between a psychiatrist and a patient, that in that moment, a lot of information there's a lot of information which is going to be immediately available and other information which is not going to be immediately available, both to the psychiatrist and to the patient. And that one of the most useful ways to access what a person's thinking and going through in a way that can help them is to explore thoughts that they might have about their doctor, about the encounter as the encounter is being carried out. And so in that case, I think that what many colleagues would say and what, you know, at this point in my career, I believe, although of course this can change, is that the kind of disclosure is I disclose all the time to patients. But at the same time, I see it as a clinical tool. An example that came up in the article is that I remember in college, there was a period of time I was quite homesick. Now, I take care of a lot of Stanford students as part of my job who are also similar going through something like that. But that's something that, and they may ask if I went through that, and I may share. But it's also, there's this very useful moment before I share in which their fantasies about what other people might experience, how alone they might be, etc., can be very useful for helping them move forward. And so that kind of self-disclosure is an important tool that a psychiatrist uses.
Part of your quiver.
Right. That's a great way to put it.
Daniel Mason here with us in studio. His new novel is The Winter Soldier, talking about a number of things, not talking about his novel, obviously, about World War I and what medicine was like back then in psychiatry, and also talking about novel writing, and eager to hear from some of you, your thoughts, and I want to welcome you to this conversation by giving you the toll-free number you can use to join us. That number is 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join us with any questions or comments. And the number again for your calls, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website and posting any questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Some of the parts of the novel, all due respect, Dr. Mason, are difficult to read. Are they difficult to write?
So they're difficult to, you know, it depends on the section of the book that you're talking about. I think that as a physician, it's probably easier to write some of the, like an amputation scene than it might be to read it, just because part of the medical training is to become used to this sort of suffering that a person sees. I found in particular writing the scenes about the psychological trauma that some of the patients experienced, that I felt much more difficult. And, you know, I think that's in part because it's hard not, during the time of writing that, to imagine what the experiences of people who I work with in a clinical setting might be like.
We'll continue with Daniel Mason. And again, feel free to join the program. Toll free, 866-733-6786 is new novel, The Winter Soldier. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Daniel Mason, who is a Stanford psychiatry professor and also has a clinical practice. And as a novelist, his new novel is called The Winter Soldier, and he has been certainly highly regarded ever since. We had a conversation back when you did The Piano Tuner, I think, didn't we?
Right, that's right.
Which a lot of people loved. And if you're a fan of Daniel's, or if you simply want to talk about and touch upon some of the things we're talking about, we welcome your involvement. Toll-free 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org. Let me bring a caller in. And, Philip, that's you. Good morning. Whoops. Philip, do we have you?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Thank you. I can.
I'm sorry. Yes. Well, thanks for having me on. I'm 76 years old, and my father was a World War I veteran who suffered from shell shock, I mean, his whole life. And it was traumatizing, of course, to the whole family. His personality and his suffering. One particular incident that was really traumatizing to me, I was about 11 years old, and we were walking San Francisco, and a car backfired, and he literally had what was kind of like almost like an epileptic fit. He just started shaking and fell to the ground, which was really, really, my whole life, you know, traumatized me, of course, to see my father going through that. And, of course, there was kind of a lifelong distrustfulness he had and kind of a paranoia suffered. He received a Purple Heart and a commendation from President Woodrow Wilson. He was also a victim of mustard gas, so, you know, a lot of trauma.
Boy, it's moving to hear you share your family experience there. And what he's describing sounds like PTSD, doesn't it, Daniel?
Yeah, well, so also I'd like to say thank you for sharing that experience. And I'm sorry that he went through that and continued to...
And that the son went through.
Right. And I think that, you know, this is one thing in the book that the character learns of as a doctor is how... you know, in school, when you learn about a disease, in a textbook, in a person, and really, as you go into practice, you begin to appreciate how much more that person's experience has these effects beyond them, in their family, in their community, and so that the suffering is situated not just in a person, but in a whole family. What you mentioned brings back one of the experiences of having published the book, which has been very meaningful, is meeting people who, grandparents or in your case, parents, experienced shell shock. And in many ways, shell shock as experienced in World War I shares a lot with the particular syndrome of PTSD, which is described now. And in many ways, it's also different. And one thing that I've been struck by, I mean, I remember having a conversation with a friend who's in his 80s, who was telling me about his father and asking me what was going on with his father after the war. And he was talking about his father had lost memory, had this traumatic loss of memory, which is not something which is a necessary part of today's diagnosis of PTSD, but which was something which was more commonly observed in patients given this diagnosis of shell shock. And it's suddenly to realize that talking to him, it felt like I was almost talking to his father, telling this story of what it was like to have gone through that experience.
We've done a lot of programs on PTSD, and I'm wondering, you think people with PTSD are better able to cope with it now because there's so much information about it? I mean, in the past, it must have been hard because so little was known.
It's hard to compare. I think that slowly we're coming to a place where, you know, hopefully there's less stigma around PTSD or mental illness in general, that there's more recognition of the symptoms and that the resources are more accessible. I think that even though there's this trend, on a whole, we still have very, very, very far to go.
Let me go to thank you, Philip, for the call and go to another caller, and that's Anthony joining us from San Jose. Anthony, you're on. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning. The treatment of soldiers with shell shock, it was called then, was in World War I, was particularly grim. They were often not believed. Their symptoms and their illness was considered oftentimes cowardice. By medical officials, their commanding officers, and even their fellow soldiers, and they were often, as you said, patched up enough and sent back to the front lines, at least in the Western Front that I know of. And this phenomena, this historical fact, was outlined in one of the many books I read about the war. Might have been Adam Hochschild's To End All Wars, but it was very graphically illustrated in a recent PBS drama called Crimson Fields. And I was wondering whether the author could comment about the treatment of the soldiers by their commanding officers and even sometimes the medical officers. And also, I wonder if you've seen the TV series The Crimson Fields, which really deals at length, and I feel quite honestly with this issue.
Thank you. I haven't seen it, but I'll certainly look for it now. And thank you for bringing up the question of treatment. So I think that, you know, we were talking about progress that's been made. Certainly at the time, the public understanding, public and official understanding of these illnesses without visible wounds was very rudimentary and poorly informed and often extremely cruel.
A lot of times they thought they were just faking again.
Right. And so there's this notion, and this was everywhere, that a soldier was malingering. And I can say as an example for this, even in textbooks from the time in which there's a recognition that, yes, it's possible for a person to develop physical and mental symptoms without an observable wound on the outside of their body. Yes, even if this is possible. So these are sort of the more enlightened doctors at the time. At the same time, in those textbooks, that chapter on, for example, let's say if they call it war neurosis or war hysteria or shell shock, that chapter was very often next to the chapter about malingering. And so there is this juxtaposition that was made consciously or not between soldiers who had psychological trauma versus someone who was just making it up. And that notion very much remained in the public and the official eye. The treatments, the doctors at the time, to their credit, didn't know what to do. Many of them were stuck in the situation that Freud described well, in which they're caught with this bind between helping their patients and sending them back to the front versus not caring them at all and for them at all. But there were forms of treatment. Hypnosis was tried. There was an effort by Freud and his followers to introduce more psychoanalysis. But the War Office on both sides were really trying to get soldiers back into fighting as fast as possible. And so they gravitated towards more aggressive treatments. And one of the most common was a form of treatment that was called active treatment. This was used on both sides of the conflict, in which a very form of aggressive form of physical therapy was used, but often electricity was used to get soldiers. For example, if a soldier had a paralysis that was due to psychological trauma, electricity would be applied to their limbs to get them to help moving their limbs at first. And at the beginning, it's possible that many doctors were using this benignly, using, for example, gentle currents that weren't painful. There began to grow these reports of certain physicians actually using very high currents that were quite painful to shock the soldiers. And actually, earlier on in the show, when I referenced Freud at this trial, that the trial was a trial of actually the most famous neurologist / psychiatrist in Vienna at the time, a man who actually went on later to win the Nobel Prize, named Julius Wagner-Jauregg. And the accusations against Wagner-Jauregg were that in his clinic they had essentially used electricity and other very brutal forms of treatment to try to terrify these soldiers out of their symptoms, but that it really crossed the line from care and into a kind of abuse.
You know, when you mention electricity, a couple of things strike me. One is shock treatment, which was administered to patients with neurotic fixations and often depression and that sort of thing, really was almost eliminated entirely for a while because of books like Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and writing of Sylvia Plath and so forth. Now it's kind of come back in smaller. I mean, there's belief in the efficacy again. And the other thing, in reading your book, all this medicine that used lice, that's coming back too in a strange way, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, so actually, just to clarify, when I mentioned using electric,
you were talking about limbs.
Yes. Yes. So they weren't. This wasn't a time when it was not shock treatment. Right. They weren't using like electroconvulsive therapy.
But I was also thinking about just how things have changed. I mean, going back to the lice example and electroshock treatments, these things come back in strange ways.
So psychiatry, you know, I think psychiatry is a field which the mind is a great mystery, and there have been discoveries along the way that people found work, then find that, so for example, early forms of electroconvulsive therapy, which you're talking about, were not used with appropriate anesthesia. That's a very different experience than electroconvulsive therapy with anesthesia. As performed today, it was very different from, for example, what one sees in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
The blood is now being taken by the kind of means, isn't it?
Yes. Well, so this is an area that I don't know as much about. People use leeches.
I said lice, and I meant leeches. Yeah.
Right. So we have returned to leeches in forms of some in some therapies, but I don't use leeches. I don't know.
Here's Andrew, who says PTSD is in the American Civil War was called soldier's heart. That's an interesting little fact that I didn't know. Did you?
Yeah. So that's a great point. One of the more puzzling parts of the human being's response to psychological trauma is there seems to be a kind of cultural and social influence on the way the symptoms are expressed. And so even if conditions are similar, so that a soldier in the Civil War experienced perhaps a similar kind of traumatic event that a soldier in World War I experienced, at that period of time, doctors were particularly focused on cardiac symptoms. And so when a soldier came in shock after experienced a horrific experience, there was focus on cardiac symptoms, and this condition, soldier's heart, was described. In World War I, at least in our current memory, it tends to be those cases of shell shocks which are more neurologically expressed that we remember. Although there was an additional category called disordered action on the heart, which DAH in short, which you find in all of the medical manuals at the time, which was recognized at that time also as a form of physical expression of psychological trauma.
Let me read a comment from Joey, who writes, "Please thank Daniel Mason for this wonderful book. After reading it, I recommended it to my husband. A week later, I looked over at him. He was sobbing and smiling too and saying, 'I just finished the book.'"
Thank you.
That's music to a novelist's ears.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me get another caller on here, and let me go next to Gary, who's joining us from San Jose. Gary, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. Hi, yeah. I want to hear the doctor's comment on this. I had heard that World War I, World War II, the shell shock, PTSD, whatever you want to call it, was actually not as prevalent, and part of the reason it was less prevalent is because the soldiers would come home in boats, take weeks, they'd be a bunch among cohorts, and they'd have time to kind of talk these things out and share the experiences together. By the time they got home, they were, instead of jumping on a plane and next thing you know, you're in L.A. or something. So anyway, I'll take your response over the radio.
Okay, thank you for the question. Daniel Mason.
Right, thank you for the question. So I've tried over time to get just for teaching in classes numbers about prevalence, and it's very hard to get numbers of prevalence. Even during the First World War, when people are trying to describe the same condition, it's very hard to get prevalence numbers. And so I've heard different things. So I've heard what you've mentioned. I've heard also that there's also the phenomenon that over time, as there's been a better understanding of the treatment of war trauma, treatment has moved forward on the line, and so men are treated earlier, and so that's actually helped in some situations. But then going back to what you're mentioning, I think that something that was appreciated then is appreciated now is that there's something very profoundly important and healing about being around other people who share one's experience.
You get that sense in your novel. I mean, the storytelling that goes on between the men, and it's almost a feeling of community and is almost cathartic in a way.
Right. In the novel, Lucius goes through months, over years even, being at home, finding no one with whom he could talk over this experience. And the experience just growing bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger in his mind. And then at a certain point, he encounters another person who is in this little village with him, and he tells his story. And the story that he tells just takes a couple of minutes to tell. And all of a sudden, he feels this extraordinary relief. And the relief comes from being in the presence of another person who shared that experience and can understand where he's coming from.
Sometimes I'm thinking about a story of Hemingway's, which you may know, called The Soldier's Home, the inability to even break out of, the trauma of war. This is a character named Krebs who comes back. It's in Hemingway's collection, In Our Time, and comes back from war and is traumatized by war and just completely removes himself more and more. He can't talk about it, and he won't talk about it. He can't socialize. He can't go to church. He can't do anything, really, and he just goes more into himself and becomes more and more isolated. It's really a powerful story and a story about PTSD long before we even knew what was going on. Here's Gary, who writes, recent discoveries have shown that being exposed to the percussive shock from explosives causes brain damage similar to that from concussions. Maybe shell shock was a good name for the injury.
Yes. So it's a great point that in many ways what the doctors were describing early on, which was that they couldn't find a physical basis. Sometimes people use the word organic basis to explain the symptoms. Of course, this is a time when brain imaging is extremely immature. People are using X-rays at best.
We should mention Marie Curie makes a cameo in your novel too. Speaking of X-rays,
right? So X-rays, the idea of being able to see inside somebody is and try to understand their mind is a big theme in the novel. And Marie Curie makes, I think, the only true cameo appearance in the book. But as brain imaging technology advances, people have found that a lot of these so-called so-called functional illnesses, meaning usually the way this is used, it's used in many different ways in medicine, but usually the way this term functional is used is that we can't find, say, evidence, for example, in imaging or in labs for the symptom, but we can see it observed. As brain imaging technology improves, it's possible now more and more to actually observe so-called functional disturbances. And so, for instance, this is not my expertise, so I sort of read it as the literature as a lay psychiatrist, but there are studies looking at the minds of people with with what would be called functional neurologic symptoms, showing that their brains, on using a technique called fMRI, actually look different from the brains of people who don't have this symptom. Parts of the brain is behaving differently. So I think the point that the caller brings up is that, in some ways these theories change over time, but as the medical technology advances, we can expect the theories to continue to change.
Well, Lucius really, as you kind of intimated, really wants to get into the head of these characters as best he can. I mean, to really understand neurologically and psychiatrically what goes on and all of that dark field. Caller wanted to mention Babylon Berlin, a long Netflix series all about World War I and PTSD. He says it's about soldiers, but also about how the general population in Berlin was traumatized during World War I. Let me ask you, before I bring on another caller, Cossacks appear in your novel. Did you read any Isaac Babel, Red Cavalry?
Well, so I did all the way back in high school. I read Babel and hadn't read him immediately prior to reading this book, and then began to read him again while working on the book. Cossacks appear. I think this was something that had astounded me. One reason why I was drawn to writing about this period of time is I had always imagined World War I as a World War I of the West. I read All Quiet on the Western Front, and I imagined the trenches and the barbed wire. But my story is set in the East, and so as I read about that, I realized that it was a totally different experience. And in the East, instead of that intense entrenchment, one found battles on open fields, and one often encountered these moments where very traditional forms of cavalry warfare met this new modern industrialized warfare all at once. And so one encounters Cossacks. And looking back at old photographs and reading old accounts, Cossack horsemen are very much, very much prevalent. At times, reading histories of World War I, one feels like one's reading in the East. One feels like one's reading the Napoleonic Wars, as described in War and Peace.
Here's another caller joining us, Phil. Welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning. My father was in World War II and in the Korean War. He served two times in China with Claire Chennault and the Flying Tigers. But in the late 90s, he developed multiple infarct dementia, and he eventually lost his ability to put together coherent sentences. But one time he said to me, "Phil, war is hell." So war must have always been on his mind. And he was eventually put into a nursing home in Texas. And one of the nurses there said to me, "They find people on the floor curled up in the fetal position, but it's only people who have been or witnessed combat." And I'm wondering if the doctor has ever witnessed something such or heard of stories such as that. On the floor, curled up, at nighttime or in the morning, the afternoon, in nursing homes, people who World War II, Korean War, and Vietnam War veterans.
Tom, you have kind of hit the target here. I mean, the soldier who gives this novel its title comes in a semi-fetal position. He's in a wheelbarrow, in fact. Yeah.
Right. He arrives all curled up, uncommunicative. And it's only slowly that his story, very, very slowly, that his story begins to come out. You know, the caller mentions what his father went through later on, and you know, I think so. In the setting that I work in, it's a little bit different than the setting that you're described. Certainly, I see many patients who sort of curl up against the world. I know with regards to war trauma, I mean, to talk about sort of these previous wars specifically, there's amazing, very moving, and I should probably say in warning, upsetting footage that was taken. Some of the first medical, first psychiatric footage that was taken was videos of film of soldiers in the First World War with shell shock. British Pathé, it's a film archive, has this, people can see them online, and a number of the soldiers that they show. Are men who are curled up under their bed. They have a very striking image of a man who suddenly seems to be responding to what seems to be bombardment, though it's no one else in the hospital is responding to bombardment that way. And then in fear, jumps out of his bed and curls up and goes underneath the bed to hide from what he imagines happening.
Let me thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Phil, good to hear from you. Let's go right to another caller in Berkeley. Jay, join us. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. In my medical practice, I work with patients who have meningeal compression. The meninges are three membranes that surround the brain and the spinal cord. And if they get twisted or torqued, they can cause a decrease in the flow of circulation of blood as well as cerebrospinal fluid. And they can also cause errant neurological impulses. And so the concussive effects of all the shells and the IEDs, things of that nature, I think have a direct impact on the meninges, and thus that could be a component of what's going on with what's literally called shell shock.
Daniel Mason?
Right, yes. No, thank you again. I think this brings up this idea, and I like the way that you use the term component, because most of the time, most of the reading the case stories of shell shock, what comes up again and again is how unclear each story is and how different each person is. So the kind of classic story that a person is fine and walking along and sees something terrible happening and then all of a sudden develops the symptoms, that story actually is a rarity. Most of the stories that I am accustomed to encounter in reading case histories of shell shock is that a person is close to explosion, maybe loses consciousness, maybe has actually quite severe injuries. And then in addition to symptoms which follow the very clear symptoms that we see, as we know the nerves are distributed and the brain anatomy is structured, then they also exhibit symptoms which are harder to understand and which are felt maybe to be more of a psychologic nature. But it's rarely clear, and it just seems impossible to imagine in that many of these cases that the impact of having such a powerful explosive near somebody doesn't have its own ramifications as well.
Let me thank Jay for his call and read a comment from Karen, who writes, I read a novel set in London around 1924 in which many of the male characters had been in the trenches. That author discussed a condition identified as the military illness, but it wasn't shell shock. It was opium addiction.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder what the book was. Many of the early medicines that were the standard medications that were used by medicine that at that time are medicines today that are known to be extremely addictive. So, during the war, for instance, my soldiers treated with a barbiturate. That's what was was available. Morphine was extremely commonly used, both for pain but also for sleep and also for anxiety. And I think that all of us today know the sequelae of heavy opiate use.
We've got seconds left here. Lisa wants to know, how did your author find time to go to medical school and write books at the same time?
Well, I've been working on this book for 14 years. So amidst 14 years, I guess it's been possible to find some time.
Well, congratulations on the novel and all the work you've done. And appreciate you very much being with us here this morning on Forum.
Thanks for having me. And thank you for all the questions over the air.
Daniel Mason, again, his new book is The Winter Soldier. Again, we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated in the evening. You can always continue this discussion online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Tina Larber, and Christina Kim, senior editor Dan Zoll, engineer Danny Bringer, engagement producer Amanda Stupai, interns Kate Wolf and Josh Koh, executive editor Ethan Lindsay, and chief content officer Holly Kernan. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.